This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, this is Debbie, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help you with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. And I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
Yeah, we can also send you samples, fast and free.
Wow, I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, no pressure, no hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Oh, okay, whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over.
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and get up to 40% off with minimum purchase. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber. Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
At your service, it's the Garden Hotline, sponsored by Chesterfield Valley Nursery, a celebration of his beauty on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
It is the Garden Hotline for a cloudy Saturday morning in late March. I'm Scott Jagow, glad to be joined by a couple of folks who've been on the show before, but not together.
It's our first time together.
That's right. Michelle Reeser-West from Pointer Landscaping and Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm super excited. We've been talking about doing this for a long time, and I think I just kind of forced it into happening, but I'm really glad to be doing it with my friend Aaron.
Well, that's right. So you guys are friends, have worked together previously, so give us a little background. What's the story?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, we work together at Wallflower Design. It's been several years now, but Michelle was actually my boss. She mentored me for several years. When I started as an intern, she is the one who kind of taught me the ropes.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was. We had some good times. She was an intern. I hadn't actually been doing horticulture too terribly long. It's kind of surprising that somebody put me in charge of an intern, but I think it turned out pretty well. We would drive around in the same truck every day, and it was a clunky old pickup truck. The second gear didn't work. It was a stick shift, so you had to go straight from first to third.
Of course.
Yeah. No air conditioning.
Oh, man.
And one of the things I think they don't teach you about in horticulture school is all the, you know, the closeness and the smelliness of sharing a truck with another individual. So we've had some funny moments, but when she first started, you know, speaking of the smelly stuff that they don't teach you about, sometimes your gloves in the summertime will get a little stinky if you use them, for a couple days, like, you know, gym socks stinky. And I said, Aaron, you got to stop bringing those gloves in the truck. Those got to stay in the trailer. And she was like, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. So a couple days pass and it's stinky in the truck again. And I was like, Aaron, what did I tell you about those gloves? And she was like, it's not the gloves, I promise. And I was like, what is it? And she said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. It's ginkgo fruit. I stuffed it in my pocket. And for those of you that don't know, ginkgo fruit is maybe the smelliest of smellies. It is one of the worst smells in the world. But yeah, Erin was always collecting seeds and bringing stuff home with her. So it was always interesting.
Yes. In my defense, I will say that ginkgo seeds, once they are roasted, are very good. But you have to clean the fruit first.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to get past the smell.
And what is the smell like?
Gross. It's like, I mean, it's like fermented gym socks or something. It is like worse. Bad. It's worse than, like, it's just gross. It's just really foul.
Wow. Great way to start the show, guys.
Yeah, you're welcome.
The number to call is 314-436-7900. That is the Garden Hotline. Again, it's 314-436-7900 to ask your question this morning of Aaron and Michelle. Let's get things started with Ed. Good morning. You're on the Garden Hotline.
Good morning. Quick question. We have a lot of chickweed in our yard. And what is the best way to eliminate that?
Eat it.
I wasn't expecting you to say that.
Eat it?
Eat it. It's edible. It actually has vitamin C. If you know that nothing's been peeing on it. Or,
I mean, that's important.
You can put it in a salad. Otherwise, it is an annual, which is nice, meaning that you once you remove it, it's not going to come back. And so you can hand pull it. You can also, if you're the spraying type, you can also use an herbicide.
Yeah, but it's an easy weed to pull. Like, it's very not easy. Really rooted in very well. So especially if you get out there when the soil's a little bit wet, it pulls super easy. You know, there's also, especially for annual weeds, you don't really have to worry so much about those tap roots. You can use a tool, it's called like a stirrup hoe or a scuff hoe, and that way you don't have to bend over and pull things. So you can just, it kind of scrapes the surface of the mulch or the soil. And then you can kind of use a rake to kind of make a pile if you have a lot, but it's a pretty handy tool. I like to use it on our cool season weeds. But it is important to get those before they go to flower and set seeds, because that's how they're going to come back for you in the fall and then again in the early spring. So yep, just good old-fashioned weeding is what I would say.
Yeah, and the stirrup hoe and a Dutch hoe or Dutch hoe are really, really helpful tools, especially if you don't want to have to bend down and get on your knees and weed that way.
Yeah, I'm a lazy gardener, so any kind of tool that can help save my back is good for me.
What do we used to say, Michelle? Work smarter, not harder.
Yep, work smarter, not harder.
There you go. All right, Ed, thanks for calling in and asking your question. 314-436-7900. Up next, we have Dan. Good morning, Dan.
Hey, good morning. I don't know what smelly socks and pee on chickweed, but I'll do my best. hey, I got raised garden beds this year where they're like raised on stilts. What is the best soil, in your opinion, to put in there?
So I have to tell you that St. Louis Compost has a really great raised garden bed mix. And they have kind of formulated it with a bunch of different. It's got some topsoil in it. It's got compost in it. I believe it's got a little bit of sand in it. But they've kind of got this great ratio that's super excellent for raised veggie beds. So that's definitely what I would recommend.
Yeah,
that's perfect. It was, now again, this is going to be, I have it on like, they're like on 24-inch, like a stilt, like metal stilts that we built, but it's not actually in the, it's not like your typical, where you're just adding soil on top of grass.
Yeah, this
so
is,
that's still gonna,
yeah, it's perfect for that.
Excellent. Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for calling in, Dan. We appreciate the call to the Garden Hotline for Aaron and Michelle. We are underway. Pretty good start so far, besides the smelly socks.
I mean, I'm having a good time.
Salad. I'm looking forward to trying that salad.
Yeah, I can tell you more weeds that you can put in your spring salad.
Okay, good. Let's do that after the break.
All right.
We'll be right back on KMOX. It's the Garden Hotline. It is the Garden Hotline on 104.1 FM KMOX. We have two guests today answering your questions. They've been here before, but they've never been together, and they're actually friends in real life. We have, kind of like Hancock and Kelly, our political guys.
Is that right?
Yeah, they're like best friends in real life.
Besties for the rest.
Yeah. All right. Michelle Reeser-West from Pointer Landscaping and Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve are taking your calls at 314-436-7900. Let's continue with the questions. Tony, good morning. You're on the Garden Hotline.
Okay, good morning. Two questions. One, is it too late for me to put down a pre-emergent?
No, that's the short answer.
Okay, good. So if I have some bare spots, we had some work done in, around the house, and there's some muddy spots that need to be replanted. Can I, like, if I were to say cover those with a tarp and then lay my pre-emergent down, you know, at the rest of the yard and then pull that up, could I plant that and that would be successful there?
I'm sorry, you kind of broke up. Did you say you were going to cover it with a tarp?
Yeah, like if I cover the areas that don't have grass with a tarp before I spread my pre-emergent around the rest of the grass and then pull that up and then replant those dead spots, will it be able to grow there even though I've got the pre-emergent, you know, nearby?
Yeah, I think that would work. As long as the pre-emergent isn't on the bare ground that you're wanting to plant in, just watch when you do water that pre-emergent in that, or if it rains, that if that area that you're wanting to plant is downhill, you might get a little bit of spillage over
Okay, excellent. All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony. We appreciate the call. Up next, we have Pat. Good morning, Pat. You're on the Garden Hotline.
Good morning. I have two questions as well. I have a 4-year-old red buckeye tree, and I noticed this year at the base of the trunk, the roots are coming out maybe 8 inches, 10 inches out from the main base. And then I noticed other like fingerling roots further out, foot and a half out or so. Should I cover those up before I put my mulch down with dirt?
So I'm just interested if that was kind of washed away with the rain or if there's some kind of just some erosion or something happening. Sometimes some trees, the roots will just kind of find the surface all on their own. We don't typically recommend covering up surface roots with a lot of soil or mulch. So if they're not showing a terrible amount, I would probably just recommend putting a little bit of mulch over the top of it and letting them kind of do their thing.
Oh, okay. And my second question, I had a bed of liriope and I dug it all out, but unfortunately it got into my grass. I guess the only way to get that is to dig it out of the grass.
That's what I would do. I mean, again, if you were into using herbicides, you could do that. But I think just a sharp shovel and getting out there and digging out. And sometimes when you remove liriope, I mean, it's got all those underground roots. So they will pop back up from time to time. So it's just kind of one of those things that you have to keep an eye out and dig them out when they reemerge. So the easiest way is just to dig them out.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate your help.
Thanks for calling in. Up next, we go to Jeremy. Good morning, Jeremy. You're on with Michelle and Aaron.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just a little background listening to you on 104.1. It's crystal clear, but I still enjoy my ball games through the 50,000-volt lightning bolt. Just call me old-fashioned.
All right.
Quick question. I've got a flower box kind of in the front of my house. It's like a retaining wall type. And it's full sun. Have had zero luck in past years keeping anything alive in it. I'm getting ready to dig it out again and just fill it with soil. And I was wondering just anything during spring and summertime that might take the brunt of that full sun. And just curious as to any recommendations there.
Yeah, so if you've got full sun and I imagine since it's a retaining wall bed, it's probably pretty dry. So one of my favorite plants for that full sun dry situation would be Calamintha. And there's a cultivar out there called Montrose White that's white. There's also a blue one, I think it's called Marvelette Blue. That is a fantastic plant for hot, sunny, dry situations. You could also look at some of our native asters, like aromatic aster. That's a mounding aster. It is going to bloom towards the end of the season, but that one can take a lot of heat and dry situations. Also look at a plant that blooms in the summertime. It's called Allium Millennium. Millennium is the cultivar. That's a really tried and true plant that can tolerate a lot of different conditions. It's vibrant purple. It usually blooms like June, July-ish. And so that'll give you some summertime blooms. The other thing you can look at for a spring bloom is we have a native phlox that's a ground cover. It's called sand phlox. And that's a lot like what you see blooming right around now. That's a ground cover phlox. The non-native one does like a little bit more moisture. The native one, that sand phlox, really likes it hot and dry. So that's another one you can look at. And it'll trail. It can kind of spill over that retaining wall bed. One more plant to check out is called rose verbena. That's another ground cover. Blooms from like June to September. So you get a lot of blooms during that period. It also is... it also has a flower a lot like a phlox, so a lot of butterflies really like it. Michelle,
fantastic. I've been waiting to place the call all week, and I certainly appreciate all the information. Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling in, Jeremy. Did you get all that?
Yeah, it was a lot. But those were all good choices, so yeah. I totally agree with Aaron's selection of those plants.
That is Michelle Reeser-West, Aaron Goss, also answering your questions this morning. Let's continue with the phone calls. Don, you're on the Garden Hotline.
Yes, thank you. I have a question regarding the pre-emergence. I have a lawn service that put pre-emergent down. How long do I have to wait after the pre-emergent is on the grass before I can overseed or reseed areas that are bare?
Probably quite a while. Most of the time, those pre-emergents are made to last, weeks to months. So typically, there is not a lot to do. So by the time that pre-emergent is kind of worn off, it's probably going to be past the time for overseeding. So you might need to wait to overseed those spots until the fall. I think an alternative could be to buy a few pieces of sod, that's already established and kind of fill those holes. But, in terms of seeding into pre-emergent lawn, I think you're a couple months away from that, most likely.
Okay, and then also the pre-emergent is down. Would it benefit me at all to aerate my yard now, or is it too late?
No, I think aeration only is fine. I think that's always helpful. People typically do it in the fall, but there's nothing wrong with doing it in the spring as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Don, for calling in at 314-436-7900. It is the Garden Hotline on KMOX, and up next, we have Phil. Good morning, Phil. What's your question?
Good morning. Is there enough nutrients in this raised garden soil to start plants from seeds?
I wouldn't recommend using that to start seeds. And the reason is that it does have organic content in it that is designed to break down over time. Too much organic content in a seed starting mix can actually burn up your seedlings. So I would look for something that is designed for seed starting, or you can also make your own. Just make sure that there's significant drainage and that there's not too much organic content in that mix.
Okay. I'm in trouble then. Okay.
Well, here's the thing. If you've already got that really rich soil in your raised beds, you can always put that seed starting mix on top, because the seeds don't need a ton of soil to germinate. So if you have your raised veggie mix or your raised garden mix already installed, then you can even remove some of it, a few inches of it, and put down like a seed starting mix.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I may have misunderstood the question a little bit. Raised garden mix in containers to start seeds. So like if you're starting your seeds inside with like tomato plants, that's going to be problematic. If you're starting seeds in the bed themselves, so like talking about melons or cucumbers, I mean, that should be fine in the raised beds.
Yeah, this is from inside containers.
Got it.
Okay. All right. Okay, maybe I'll just...
Well, good luck. Maybe it'll happen anyway. Talk nice to them.
There we go.
All right, Phil, thanks for calling in. It is 314-436-7900. Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve. Aaron, what's the latest there? What's going on at the Nature Reserve these days?
Oh, well, spring has sprung. So if anybody is feeling like hiking, it's a great time of the year to visit the Nature Reserve. All the bluebells they're up. And they're starting to bloom. So along the river trail is a really beautiful hike. You'll see just carpets of bluebells everywhere. We also are celebrating our 100th anniversary.
That's right.
And so we do have guided hikes. We have different events that are historical based, celebrating the history of the reserve.
Nice. There's lots of events this year, too, for the celebration.
Yes, very true.
And Michelle Reeser-West, also here from Pointer Landscaping. Anything new to report?
I really am just trying to keep my head above water in my world. It's so busy. In fact, my mom called me yesterday and was like, when can we see you? And I was like, well, how's June? So, yeah, we're just really busy just trying to just get work done. So
it's that time of year.
It's that time of year. I'm not complaining. It's what we live for, I think.
Yeah. It's like tax season, gardening season.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's continue with the phone calls after a break. 314-436-7900. That's the number to call to ask your question of Michelle and Aaron. Stay with us. It is the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX. The Garden Hotline on 104.1 FM KMOX. I'm Scott Jagow, along with Michelle Reeser-West from Pointer Landscaping. She's been here before. So has Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve. She's been here before, too, but they've never been here together. So we have double trouble today. Answering your questions at 314-436-7900. I have a 101 question. If I think about the last few months on the show, there are certain themes that come up. Zoysia grass is one of them. Cicadas last summer. Moles and voles. And then the other one recently is pre-emergent. Can you explain, Aaron, what exactly a pre-emergent is and what it does?
Sure. So a pre-emergent is a chemical that stops the germination of seedlings, of seeds. And the other thing that it does is it also stops any kind of plant from dropping its like a strawberry, where you have the little offshoot of the parent plant and it's dropping a daughter plant down, it'll stop that daughter plant from actually forming roots and anchoring itself into the ground. So a pre-emergent normally is applied to a space where you want to stop like spring or summer weeds from germinating. And there's two times a year that most people put it down. Once in the fall, and that's usually to cover the spring and winter weeds, and then also in the spring that helps to stop the growth of summer weeds.
That's a good explanation, Michelle. Do you do a lot of that in your landscaping?
We do. So essentially, this pre-emergent is a granular product for most people. Some people do put it down in a liquid form, but it's a barrier that goes down. Once it's watered in, it kind of creates a shield almost across the surface of the soil. So any seeds that are coming up, and I actually think they do germinate, but as they go through that barrier, they are killed by the chemical that's put down. So people use it in their lawns. People use it in their garden beds. And it's not a guaranteed you have no weeds kind of thing. It's just, you know, it's a very helpful tool. I know a lot of people aren't really into using chemicals in their yards, but sometimes that is an exception for people, especially folks that don't have a lot of time to be out hand weeding in their beds, or people that are, you know, really into their turf. And if you've listened to me before, you know that I'm not a huge fan of grass, but I know that it's a big topic for a lot of people. But the pre-emergent is kind of a helpful tool for people. You know, we use it a lot in our garden beds, especially on large properties that have big open mulch spaces. And we don't always have a lot of time, or people don't always want to spend those dollars for hand weeding, and it's easier to put down some pre-emergent. But, you know, it's a helpful tool. And like Aaron said, it is predominantly used in the spring and the fall because a lot of weeds are like temperature dependent. So as soon as that soil temperature gets to a certain degree in the spring, we have a set of weeds that emerge. And then in the fall, again, there's some cool season weeds as those temperatures change. And this is especially in our turf areas. We typically in our garden beds do a summer application as well, just because there are a lot of summer weeds that pop up in our garden beds. So typically three times a year is what we're doing for pre-emergent in our garden beds.
I want to go back to a topic that we addressed earlier a little bit, and that is edible plants or flowers. Or Aaron, you had mentioned one, a caller was asking about one specific one, and you said eat it.
Yeah.
So what are some that people can plant now or that are kind of trendy or maybe people don't know about?
Yeah, so shockingly, quite a few of our weeds or plants that we consider weeds are edible. So think about dandelions, chickweed, purslane, violets, plantain. All of those can be used either in the kitchen or making tea. And so these are all plants that actually came over with as Europeans were colonizing the U.S., a lot of these plants were part of the European herbal tradition. Mm. And so they came over with Europeans. And so, for example, plantain is called white man's footprint because everywhere colonists went, they took their plantain with them. And so dandelion, every part of the dandelion is actually useful. So you can eat the flowers, you can eat the leaves, you can roast and eat the root. You can also make flutes out of the stems.
Flutes?
Flutes, yes. Some people will carve little holes in them, and then you can use it to make a flute, which is kind of fun. Purslane is incredibly high in vitamin C. Purslane is a weed that we see more in the summertime. It's real succulent, and it's really pretty tasty. Violets that are blooming right now, you can collect the flowers. You can put them in tea. You can put them in a salad. And they're quite lovely. And their leaves are also used to make teas. They have mucus in them. And so they can be good for putting into cosmetics. And then there are other flowers like yarrow flowers are edible. Borage flowers are edible. A lot of people will pair borage with tomato plants. Mm. And then other like cucumber flowers are edible. Obviously, you can eat squash flowers. There are a lot of flowers out there that are actually edible. Redbud flowers are edible. If you've never had a redbud flower, wait till they open up, pull one off the tree, stick it in your mouth, and then it tastes a lot like a sweet pea.
Okay.
I would just like to say, first of all, Aaron said the word mucus, which I don't necessarily associate that with eating things, but I do want to say also that if you're out foraging for these weeds to eat, I would really recommend that, you know, it's not in a place where your dog has gone to the bathroom, or it's not in a place that there may have been, you know, some kind of chemical put down. So I definitely, you know, a more natural area or someplace that you have control over, like in your own yard, and not necessarily off of the sidewalk that's, you know, in your neighborhood. So definitely yes. Beware of the weeds that you're pulling and eating. But some of those are tasty for sure.
Thank you, Michelle. That is a very, very important good point.
I'm here for the people.
We actually cultivate some of these weeds in our garden. So we have little areas where we let the violets go.
At the nature reserve?
Oh, I'm sorry. In my personal garden.
Oh, your personal garden.
In my personal garden, we have little sections where we cultivate some of these weeds. And then we harvest them and eat them.
How about that? Michelle, do you do that as well?
I do not do that.
No?
Nope. None of that happening at my house.
Well, I was thinking, you know, when you were talking about you got to be careful with what you're getting into, you know, mushrooms, for example, in the forest. You can't just willy-nilly pick up a mushroom.
No, but you know what time it is. I know some people out there are patiently waiting. It's morel mushroom hunting time.
Is it?
Yeah. So I've heard through the grapevine that morel mushrooms have been spotted in the St. Louis area. So I don't know about the rest of you out there, but I think I'm going to be popping my head in the woods this weekend to see what I can see.
Is that an annual thing?
I don't know about morel mushrooms?
I mean, no, I don't.
Oh, my God. So these morel mushrooms, they can't be cultivated. They haven't quite figured out how to cultivate them yet. So they're wild mushrooms. And people, like, all over the place just go gaga over these things. You can sell them. I think last year they were going for, like, $25 a pound or something like that.
Wow.
So restaurants love them. Foodies love them. But they're just really tasty little mushrooms that aren't available, only available for this period of time once a year. And you have to go and hunt for them out in the woods. And I mean, I've been doing it since I was a little kid. I remember going out with my grandma and my grandpa into the woods and trying to find morel mushrooms for hours. Huh. And I do it now, like every year. It's just a thing that we do in my family. It's a tradition of mushroom hunting. And I think it's a huge thing for a lot of people.
And now's the time.
Yeah, it's starting. So I think right now they're probably still pretty small, but we had an 80-degree day the other day. We've had some warmer weather. So this is also like soil temperature related. So we're early. I think it's early in the season, but south-facing sunny slopes right now, I think you could maybe get lucky and find some small ones or start scouting out your spots. But I'm super excited about it. I love morel mushroom season for sure.
Are they scarce or are they abundant?
Oh, there's tons of them, especially if you have the right spot. And people are nuts about keeping their spots secret. Like, nobody ever tells where their spots are, their honey holes, they call them. And nobody tells. My mom has a spot that she won't even tell me because in my family,
what?
We keep count and how many you've got, who's got what. What sizes? My mom always puts a dollar bill next to hers for perspective, so everybody can see how big her morel mushrooms are. So that's also like a pride point. Like if you're getting these puny little mushrooms, you're picking them too early. You should wait till they're bigger. So it's a big deal in my family and for a lot of people. We're not the only weird ones. The people across the state of Missouri and the country are nuts about morels.
I got to ask you a question, Michelle.
Yeah.
Have you trained Turtle to go morel hunting?
Yeah, Turtle's my dog. And no, Turtle is, she's not outdoorsy. She likes to stay on the patio.
All right.
Yeah. I'm glad I brought up the topic of mushrooms.
Yes,
though,
thank
because
you.
That led to that great story.
It's great. Yeah.
What are they best in? I'm sure I've had them at a restaurant, but what are they best in terms of dishes?
So I think most people just fry them, right? Like they do a breading and there's, you know, some people like to just do it in flour. Some people have other breadings that they use. But, you know, Katie's Pizza and Pasta.
Ooh, yeah.
Lord, they make a morel mushroom pizza that is so good. People like a lot of pastas people use it in, but I don't know. There's so many options, but I think the main thing is the fried morel mushrooms is the go-to for most people.
And you can buy them dried.
Yeah.
I think, what is it, Ozark Mushroom Farm?
Yeah. And even like, you know, the grocery store will have like a small pack of dried ones, but they're silly expensive. And you don't get the glory of hunting them and eating. They taste so much better when you find them yourself.
Yeah.
That's very true.
It's like going fishing.
That's right.
Eating
That's
your right. fish. All right, the number to call for your question, mushrooms or not, 314-436-7900. Aaron and Michelle will take those calls after a short break. It is the Garden Hotline on KMOX. We're back. Aaron and Michelle are here to answer your questions. We have a full bank of phones to get to. 314-436-7900 is the number. John, you're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to correct the late. I've been hunting mushrooms, morel mushrooms, for about 60 years. We did the same thing in our family, and they're only out for like 3 weeks. And the lady, not sure which one it was, but the one with the monotone voice, that when the mushrooms are out, they come out in one size. So when they pop up, they're one size. They don't grow the next day and the next day. They're the size they're going to be when they come out.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Cool. Thanks
yep.
for the call.
They've been filmed on camera before, you know, and they'll be, they're either going to be a big tall one or they're going to be a little one. And the black or darker ones come out first, and they're usually small. Then later on, maybe a week later, the yellows and the whites come out, and they're usually a little bigger. But they are delicious. We cut them in half, soak them in salt water to get the bugs out of them, and then we dip them in an egg and milk batter, and then we grind up some saltine crackers in a grinder and roll them in that and fry them in a lot of butter, and they are the best thing you've ever had in your life.
Wow.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it sounds
I like them better than filet mignon. I like them better than filet mignon.
Wow. I mean, I could probably agree with you on that. I mean, because it's so rare. Like, it's just this short period of time. You can get a steak anywhere all year long, and you can't get fried morels like that. So.
That's right.
Thanks for the information. Appreciate it.
Yep. Oh, yeah, you bet. Thank you for telling everybody about them.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Thanks, John. Appreciate Thank the call. Up next, we have Jim. Good morning, Jim.
Yeah, hello there. Good show this morning. Thanks.
Thank you.
So, I have a question about my boxwood plants. They're getting old, maybe 15 or 20 years, and they look pretty raggedy. So my landscaper guy came over and looked at the plants, and he said, he opened the leaves up and showed me these tiny little worms in there. And he said, we have boxwood leaf miners.
Correct.
So he's recommended three applications of a strong insecticide starting now, I guess, three times this spring or three times this summer. Now, is that going to work? Are they going to kill those worms?
Yeah, so you're correct. They're leaf miner. And it's a really good time to spot them right now. And for those of you out there that might be wondering if you have these little worms in your boxwood leaf miner, you can go out. And typically your boxwoods are already showing signs of an infestation. You might see some leaves that have dropped or some discolored leaves. But if you go out to your boxwoods and you pick one of the leaves off or look first to see if you can find a leaf that looks like it's got some bubbled up surface of it, and you can kind of split it in half, and there are these little orange larvae inside, and it's a leaf miner. So it's kind of gross, but I think it's actually kind of cool. They're cute little orange worms, but they are treatable, and it's important to do multiple applications. So what we typically do is we do a granular application sometimes of imidacloprid, and we put that down, and that is a systemic insecticide where the shrub will take up that insecticide, and then as the little worms are kind of munching on the leaves, then that is how they ingest it, and then the little bugs are killed. So very soon, typically it's a late April or May, but it depends on the weather, these guys are going to hatch and become little flies. So you might walk out to your boxwoods and there might be little tiny little flies swarming around your boxwoods. And in this situation, if you catch them at that time, you can spray the bugs directly. But what those flies are going to do is they're going to mate and they're going to lay more eggs inside of your boxwoods. So you can use a spray, and there is a spray imidacloprid. There's other products out there, other insecticides that work for leaf miner. But sometimes it's about that timing, just depending on what time of year it is and what, you know, stage those bugs are in is basically how I would determine. But right now with them being in that larval stage and they're eating the leaves, it's that granular imidacloprid is what I would use right now. But your lawn guy is correct. It's probably going to take multiple applications, but it should work.
So what's the success rate on treating these bugs this year?
I think it's pretty good. And then I would also recommend probably doing a fertilizer in the fall. I think we got to take a break, but good luck with that, and thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We'll continue our phone calls after the top of the hour. Stay tuned. It's the Garden Hotline on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX. Now into the second hour of the Garden Hotline with Michelle Reeser-West from Pointer Landscaping and Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve answering your questions this morning. The number is 314-436-7900. Let's continue with the phone calls. Sharon, you're up next on the Garden Hotline. Good morning, Sharon.
Is it my turn?
It sure is.
Okay, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about solarizing or solarization. I have a bed of ground cover that I have been struggling with for some time. It came in beautiful for years and years, and then all of a sudden it started declining. So doing a little research, I felt that what I was reading had to do with something in the soil that was causing a problem with anything that was growing there, and solarization was the answer. Recently, I went back online, and it said that solarizing should be done 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't do it that way. I put the plastic down last fall, and it's been covered all winter. I just removed it, And I'm having some trees removed in this bed as well, so I'm going to wait a little bit. But in the meantime, I wanted to reinvigorate the soil. And what I read online was that you could use grass clippings instead of or along with compost. I'm just wondering how what your thoughts are about reinvigorating the soil so that when I do replant this fall, I'll have a good bed to put the new plants in.
Yeah, so a couple things that you can do. You can go ahead and put some grass clippings down with mixed with compost. That's going to take a little bit a longer time in order to reinvigorate that soil. What I would suggest is going out and finding a product called MycoBloom or something else that's a mycorrhizal fungi that you can then add into the soil. And that what that's going to do is jumpstart some of the microbial activity again in the soil. That's like the good microbes. Because what happens with solarization is you kill everything within that soil profile. And
right.
So adding in some of that mycorrhizal fungi would help. And then also adding in the organic material like compost or grass clippings. Now, that's not going to make your soil super duper great by the fall. It's because, again, that takes some time for everything to break down. One thing you could do is you could go ahead and mulch that area and get it covered so that you don't have weed seeds and getting into the soil underneath. And then you can plant into that mulch as long as you dig your hole, get down to the soil, and then plant into it.
And what are you recommending the mulch to be?
If you want something that's fast-acting and going to break down fairly quickly, it's going to be leaf mulch. Sometimes that's called also leaf compost, but leaf is what you're looking for. That's the mulch that's going to break down the quickest and put the most organic content back into the soil the fastest. If you go with a oak bark mulch, that's going to take more time but it also will hold longer.
Okay, well, if the plants take over, then they will cover the area. What I'm thinking about, or what I am using, I should say, is Vinca Minor. And it seems to spread pretty quickly and cover pretty quickly. So what you just said about covering it, I don't really need to worry about that because if the plants take hold, sure, they will cover.
Yeah, that makes
correct?
Sense. Yep. If you've got a ground cover that's really aggressive, then having that mulch down is not going to be as important. You can, with that said, however, you can put like a thin layer of mulch down, mainly just for aesthetics.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in, Sharon. We appreciate it. Up next, let's go to Ken. You are on the Garden Hotline, Ken.
Yes, good morning. Two items. I have a 3-acre yard. In the back, I've got trees and a lot of the honeysuckle bush growing. I intend to clean that out this summer. Can I use that for mulch around my trees?
The honeysuckle?
Yes, ground up.
That's a good question, and I don't actually know the answer, but if we kind of troubleshoot this a little bit, my knee-jerk reaction is to say no, and the reason that I think is no is that if you still have any kind of berries or, that reproductive structure left on those branches, and even if you grind that up, those seeds are still going to be present. So I would either, in my opinion, I would get rid of all of that debris somehow, either taking it to a green waste facility or burning. But I wouldn't recommend using it. What do you think, Aaron?
So if you're absolutely right, Michelle, if there's still berries on the plant, it's going to be a problem. If you do, one thing you could do is to pile the honeysuckle up, just put it in a pile somewhere on your property. If you have 3 acres, you probably can find a space. Make sure that the berries are not on the honeysuckle, But and then let that pile dry for a little while. Let it just make sure that all of that honeysuckle is dead and none of that wood is green anymore. Once it's past its green stage, and provided there's no seeds on the honeysuckle itself, then you can grind it and you shouldn't have a problem going forward with using that as mulch. But it does take a little bit more time, and you do have to be more mindful about how you actually prepare that. The chipping process.
I'm behind on my mulching, so if I have to wait, I will probably go ahead to my St. Louis composting and get theirs and put it down. Second question, I have wild onion, wild garlic, whichever, and it's taking over, and I'm not going to dig out 3 acres worth of wild onion, so what is my plan B?
Aaron's going to tell you to eat it.
That is my answer. But that's a lot. That's a lot of wild onion, wild garlic to eat. Those are tricky because you have to basically get all of the little bulbs and bulblets out or it's going to regrow. I don't know about an herbicide that will treat that. Michelle, do you know about an herbicide?
I would do 2D. Roundup will do it, or you can mix Roundup with or glyphosate with maybe 2D.
Okay, in the yard, I would be a little hesitant with the Roundup.
Yep. Mm.
But, yeah, for some of the other areas, I can apply that. Okay, thank you, ladies. It's much appreciated.
Good luck.
Aaron, you got really excited about the wild onion and the wild garlic there.
I know, if y'all could have seen her face.
She
was really excited when he said that. I wish I had a picture.
I love eating the weeds.
That's a weirdo. I was going to say, you probably should get a lot of mouthwash if you're doing all that garlic.
That'd be funky.
Or someone who doesn't mind.
Yeah.
314-436-7900. That is the Garden Hotline. Aaron and Michelle answering your questions this morning, and we'll continue with your phone calls in just a moment on KMOX. As always, we're taking your questions on the Garden Hotline. Today it is for two of our guests, Michelle Reeser-West from Pointer Landscaping and Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve. Let's go next to Bob. You are on the Garden Hotline. Good morning.
Yes, I was wondering if you could tell me what the lifespan of a yucca plant was. And the reason I'm asking, my oldest son is 60, and he bought this plant for my wife when he was 16 years old, and we still have it.
Wow.
Wow. I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is it's around forever.
I'm sorry, what?
Those are very long-lasting plants. I mean, we have some remnants from back when, in natural areas, back where there used to be houses in the early, early 1900s, and you'll still see remnants of the yuccas planting out.
Wow.
The wood. So
I've got this thing in a pot that's probably almost 30 inches in diameter, and every year I put it on the front porch, and then I drag it in the wintertime when winter starts and put it inside.
You know, I'm always, when people call in and ask questions about these plants that they've had in pots that they bring inside and outside every year and that they've had for, you know, all of this time, 60 years is an impressive amount of time to have something growing in a pot. And, you know, last month we had a caller, and it was my birthday weekend, and he had a plant that they had gotten for their wedding as a gift. And they had had it for 44 years, and it happened to be my 44th birthday that weekend. And to me, like, I've barely kept myself alive for 44 years, and to have somebody keep a plant alive in a pot for that long is always super impressive to me. But the yuccas can last forever. I mean, they don't really care. They're super tough plants. In fact, it's almost impossible to kill them. You can put straight Roundup concentrate on the roots, and it will not die. But there are varieties of yuccas, like in Joshua tree, that they think are like upwards of 300 years old. So some of these yuccas can live a long time. But I would, you know, most of our like landscape yuccas are, I would say, probably 50-year lifespan or something like that if they're in the ground. But it's impressive that you guys have been able to keep it alive in a pot. So good for you.
A few years ago, it got so tall, we didn't know what to do because it was getting hard to get inside. Mm-hmm. So I cut it back. and it just kept on growing, and it's looking good and doing fine. And all we do is give it some water every now and then. And then occasionally my wife used to put like Miracle-Gro in the ground.
Well, you're doing a good job. Congratulations.
Thank you. And she's passed away a few months ago, so I'm taking care of it now.
I'm sure you're going to do a good job. I believe in you. Thanks for the
Thank
call.
You. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Bob. Up next, we have Barbara. Barbara, you are on the Garden Hotline with Michelle and Aaron.
Good morning. I have questions about houseplants. Just recently, my mother passed away, and there were several plants that my sister, brother, and I, took home. And there is one, as far as I can tell, it has a peace lily, philodendron, calathea, dracaena, and pothos. But I've already removed one of the plants from the collection in this one, and the peace lily is starting to get dark tips, dry dark tips on them, on the leaves. I'm just wondering, I've never had real good success with these house plants. Philodendrons, I usually do pretty good, but how can I take care of these plants so that they do thrive?
Are you saying they're all in one container, like they came in an arrangement and they're all planted together?
Yes.
So what my number one recommendation is they put these plants together for these really nice displays, and they look really good when they show up. But for the most part, those plants don't have the same requirements. So they may need different amounts of water. They may need different amounts of sunlight. They may require different amounts of drainage or different soil, depending on what comes in these types of displays from a florist. So what I would recommend is to get a pot for each one of those and replant them in their own little separate environment. And then depending on all those plants that you listed, all have different, like I said, different needs. So I would, just make sure you're clear on which plant is what, and then figure out what requirements those plants need, and what watering and what sunlight. And I think that'll do a lot better for you in that way.
Okay. My peace lily, I have one that is separated from all the rest, and it's getting the dark tips. What is probably the reason for, the dark tips on the peace lily?
So mine does that from time to time, and I think it's inconsistent watering. Most of the problem when you have with those peace lilies, it's either the amount of sunlight they're getting or the amount of water. And I find, at least in my house where I pretty much kill all houseplants, is most of the time it's inconsistent watering. I love plants, but houseplants is like they just come home to die at my house. So I really probably shouldn't be giving advice on houseplants, to be honest. But it's most of the time with my peace lily, it's inconsistent watering when I get those brown tips. And if I do a better job, and I have to set an alarm, a little reminder on my phone, like Thursday night, water all the plants. So if not, I just forget about it and come back a few weeks later and they're dead. So I would just say consistent watering and sing songs or talk nice to them also. They like that.
Okay. I have a dracaena that's in the, a philodendron that gets the morning light. It thrives. Mm-hmm. It's really very, it's beautiful. If I forget to, it's a very forgiving plant. But a question I have is there are apps that you can put on your phone, iPad, that you take a picture of your plant that is having a problem, and it tells you to, maybe put milk in the water, or, less water or something like that. Are those apps legitimate?
I have not used any of those types of apps. I know there's a lot of things out there. And there's always a lot of these hacks that people do about, using milk or all of these things. And to answer that, I don't know about that trick. I've never heard it. So I would say use it at your own risk, and maybe use it and call us back and let us know. So I would say good luck with that. And I know we have a lot of callers on the line, so we're going to get to the next one.
The next one is Don. Don, you are on the Garden Hotline. Good morning.
Hello, Michelle and Aaron. How are you?
Great.
Michelle, I'm actually the guy that called you last month around your birthday with the 44-year-old corn plant. It's still going strong.
I'm glad to hear
but
it.
I have another question today, is that we're behind our mulching outside. We have beds, front yard and backyard. But we've never really settled on what's the best layer to put down between the mulch and the ground to prevent weeds. We've used newspapers. We've used the commercial tarps that are porous. We've used garbage bags that don't have holes in them. We've had mixed success with each of them. The newspaper decays halfway through the year, and then weeds start coming up. The garbage bags smother the ground. But do you have a preference for what you use?
Yeah, I'm going to let Aaron answer this question, but I just want to thank you again for calling back. And I've been telling people this story about my birthday weekend and you having that plant. I mean, I just retold it on the air. So I love that story that you called in, but I'll let Aaron go ahead and answer this question for you. But thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Michelle. So as far as a barrier between your mulch and the soil itself, I find that I have pretty good success using cardboard. So instead of using newspaper that's thinner, use a thicker cardboard and lay that down and then put your mulch on top. But whatever you use, whatever barrier you're using, make sure that it is porous and that water can infiltrate to the soil beneath it. If you use something like plastic, then what that does is it creates a situation where you have water pooling on top of that plastic, and no water is getting through to the soil below, which can then do some damage to the soil, and then obviously it's going to impact the plants. So really try to use a thicker cardboard if you can. Another thing is that pretty much anything you use, you're going to have weeds. It may take a few years for those weeds to show up, but whatever barrier you're using, weed seeds are going to end up on top of that barrier in the soil that's forming where you have the mulch. So there's really not a magic bullet to like stop all weeds from growing. But you can use like a barrier like cardboard to help prolong the buildup of weeds. But just make sure whatever barrier you do use is porous.
We have plenty of cardboard, so we'll go to work with that. Thank you. I do have another question for you. That, as I explained a month ago, I live in South Carolina. I've listened to KMOX on the Odyssey app. Why is a guy from South Carolina calling in on the show? It's because I grew up in St. Louis in the 60s when I was a kid. I've lived in the South most of my adult life, but I'm a huge Cardinals fan, Blues, and everything else, so I just enjoy the programming on KMOX. But anywho, I grew up on Pershing in West St. Louis, out in the Washington U, Jefferson Memorial area. The streetcar went behind my backyard, and then they tore it up and put the Forest Park Parkway in there. But we had a beautiful hedge in our front yard that was honeysuckle, and it's as nice as it looked, it smelled even better. It's still my favorite fragrance, but I see honeysuckle grow in the wild here in South Carolina, but I would love to get my hands on some and just have some of it growing in one of our beds and just add fragrance to our property. Is that sold commercially, and is there a trick to getting it going, or whatnot?
So I would love to answer this question, but we're going to have to take a quick break. So why don't we get to that when we come back?
It's the Garden Hotline on 104.1 FM KMOX. I'm Scott Jagow, joined today by Michelle Reeser-West from Pointer Landscaping and Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve, taking your calls 314-436-7900. That is the Garden Hotline. Up next, we have Shelley. Good morning, Shelley.
Good morning. I have a question. We recently had some work done by the city on our sidewalks, and they did a real number on our zoysia. And so there's a huge patch that they cut out. And I'm wondering, like, what's the best way to do that? Is it sod or seed? Like, we just had the most beautiful lawn, and now it looks terrible.
Zoysia, you can get sod. It's a little early for zoysia sod because it's a warm season grass. So that's what, if you're wanting to match your existing zoysia, that's how you'll have to do it. I don't believe there's zoysia seed that you can put down. So, but I would say here, probably in the next few weeks, the zoysia sod will become available. So if you can kind of keep it cleaned up and weed free until then that would be my recommendation for you.
Awesome. And then my other question is, you were talking about plants that are in a pot that live forever. I have, I think it's almost 50 years old, a philodendron that I've inherited from my mother that is massive. And it's way too big for me to have in my house. And I have been trying to find a new home for it. Do you know of any places in St. Louis that will take that? I tried to call Missouri Botanical Garden and they said they don't take plants from other people. So I didn't know if there was anything like that you're aware of.
This is now the Plant Adoption Hotline, everybody. Welcome to the Plant Adoption Hotline. Honestly, I would maybe think about like a Facebook marketplace or some online place like that. And, you know, say free plant to good home, and you can interview all the applicants and make sure it's going somewhere nice.
Yeah, I know. That's my concern. My mom lived for this thing. So it's like not something I want to take lightly.
Yeah, I know. I understand. But I think that would be a good resource, or find a group on Facebook that's, you know, Philodendron Lovers Are Us or something like that. And, you know, find somebody out there that would take it. But good luck to you. Thanks for the call.
Thanks. That's a great idea. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in, Shelley. Up next, we have John. John, you're on the Garden Hotline.
Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. Go ahead.
I have like 5-year-old Dawn Redwoods and about 10-year-old bald cypresses. And I've let them grow so that the branches go all the way to the ground.
Nice.
I'm wanting to limb them up. I just want to know if it's the wrong time to do that.
And normally for trees, you're going to prune during the dormant season, depending on how big these trees are and how high you're wanting to prune.
Just like so I can get my mower around them a little easier.
Oh, yeah, okay. has the bald cypress left leafed out yet?
They both, the cypress and the redwood, are just starting to turn little bits of green on the, you know, just starting.
Okay.
I'd
say you're okay to go ahead and prune that back. Michelle, do you agree? Do you disagree?
Yeah, I think if they haven't really started leafing out yet, I would go ahead and do it. Then once they start leafing out, you might just give them a little bit of time to finish that process and then do some pruning just so they can send all that energy into making those leaves happen. And you know, it should be fine, especially if you're just doing a few lower branches to get that mower under. And, you know, we always try to follow the rule of thirds with pruning. So if it's still a relatively small tree, I wouldn't take more than a third at a time. But I think you should be good.
Yeah, they're probably, I don't know, 25 foot tall. And the cypresses are 30, 40 foot tall.
Yeah, so. I think you should be okay if you follow that that rule. Thanks so much.
And as far as old plants, I have Aspidistris, I think is how you say it, the iron plant, with a photo from that plant on my wife's mother's aunt's house from 1904.
Wow.
So cool.
That's awesome.
That's really cool. I love these stories.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in, John. We appreciate it. 1904, that was World Fair. Mary, you're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Good morning. We've never been to the nature preserve. My mother's in a wheelchair. Are there things for us to do besides hiking out there?
Yeah, so there is the Whitmire Wildflower Garden, and that is it's a 100% native Missouri native plant garden, but it's developed to showcase different styles of gardening. So there's some more formal gardens, and then there's some less formal gardens. But we do have paved concrete paths through quite a bit of the wildflower garden. So that's for someone who is in a wheelchair, that's probably the best place to go to visit. Most of the other areas around the reserve, the nature reserve, those paths are going to be rock or chat.
And do you rent wheelchairs like you do at the botanical garden?
We don't, actually.
The electric ones.
Yeah, the electric ones. Okay. Unfortunately, we do not have any kind of electric wheelchairs available or wheelchairs available. We don't have a huge visitor center, and we don't have the visitorship like the main botanical garden.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, good question there about the Shaw Nature Reserve. Aaron Goss is with the Nature Reserve. Also, Michelle Reeser-West from Pointer Landscaping taking your questions. Let's go to Lisa. Good morning, Lisa. You're on the Garden Hotline.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, good. I have a question about a chameleon plant. I planted one in my yard, and it has just spread everywhere. And I put down cardboard, and it just pops out the other side. I don't know how to get rid of it.
Yeah, I don't even know how to tell you to get rid of it. Is Houtenia is what I believe you're talking about. And, you know, at the beginning of the show, we were talking about smelly things in the garden. And for me, that is definitely one of them. I'm not a big fan of the smell of that. Like when you're pulling it or you break the leaf.
Yeah,
it's awful. But this is one that is really difficult to get rid of, even with herbicides. So, you know, as a professional landscaping company, we've been asked to remove this several times. We even had some at our offices for a time as well, and we had several concoctions and mixtures of different herbicides that we used, because digging it out is impossible. It's not impossible. It will take some effort. You'll have to dig it out. It'll grow back. You'll dig it out again. It'll grow back. So it is one that's just really, really hard. And again, I'm not always the biggest, backer of using herbicides or pesticides, but this is one that I almost always think that you need to. But it's going to take multiple applications, even if you're using, whether you're digging it out, whether you're using that herbicide, it's going to take multiple applications, and it's going to take you a while to get it under control. Don't you think, Erin?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it is a very tough plant, but you can make a tea out of it.
Oh, you can eat it.
You can eat it.
We're back to the
So good luck.
I also have a comment.
Yep.
My Aunt Mary lives on a farm out in the country, and she grows morel mushrooms every year, and she doesn't pick them when they're small. She says they get bigger, they grow. So,
yeah, I know. I'm going to have to Google this after the show. It's going to be the learning bit of the day for me. Is this morel mushrooms don't grow. It's blowing my mind. But thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. All right, last chance coming up. 314-436-7900 if you want to get your question in for Michelle and Aaron on the Garden Hotline on 104.1 FM KMOX. The last segment of the show for today, and we're going to answer your questions as quickly as we can with Michelle and Aaron. Let's go to the phones. Up first, we have Kurt. Good morning, Kurt.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Hey, I was just wondering, is it possible to overfeed a young tree? Like putting compost down every year?
I believe, it could be possible. It depends on what you're putting down. But I think if you're just talking about putting like a compost ring for like mulch or something around the top of it, I don't think that's going to do it. I think, over fertilization is definitely an issue to consider. But as far as, like using compost or something like that, I don't think you should have a huge problem, because that's going to slowly affect soil over time. And it's not an immediate an immediate change for a new tree.
Yeah, the only thing.
I'm trying to feed a couple of trees. I mulch a couple of trees every year. Instead of buying mulch, I've been buying mulch compost combination stuff. So.
Yeah,
I don't think that's a bad idea or not.
No, I think that's a great idea. In fact, I mean, you think about where your trees are most of the time in their natural state. They're in a leaf litter or something like that. So leaf compost, I think, is the best for things like that, especially new trees. So I think you're going to be good. Thanks for the call.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Up next, we have Nettie. Good morning, Nettie. You are on the Garden Hotline.
Thank you. I need to know how to trim a red twigged dogwood.
You're going to get your pruners. You're going to go out there. So right now is a great time. They haven't leafed out yet. And there's a couple different approaches. I know at Mobot, they cut their red twig dogwoods down every single year. So they have nice, new, fresh, vibrant, colored branches. If you haven't done that in a few years, I would totally recommend it. It helps with the overall health. It also helps to keep the size in check. So if you haven't done it yet, you could still go out there right now and with your pruners or with some loppers and cut it all the way back to the ground.
Totally to the ground?
For sure. Yep. All the way to the ground. And then it will push out new growth. And like I said, it would be really vibrant red. The other thing you can do if you're a little shy to do that, you can go in and just prune out the older, thicker, branches all the way back to the ground, like any of them that are no longer holding that red color. They may be a little gray or brown. And you can do, if you're too nervous to do the whole plant, you could do, you know, a third or all of those older branches. But I would not be afraid to cut those red twigs all the way back to the ground.
Thank you.
Yep. Good luck.
Thanks for the question, Nettie. Scott, you're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Hello, I've got a 30-year-old Bradford pear that lost three large lower branches in this last storm. Is there anything I need to do to help with the injury, or is it a lost cause?
So with the Bradford pear, they are very weak-limbed. So the first thing you're going to want to do is make sure wherever the branch broke, try to clean up that cut and make sure that it's a clean cut and not a rip. With that said, Bradford pears are technically an invasive species, so I would also encourage you to consider removing it. So laying the grounds right now, putting a plan in place for how to remove that and then what to plant in its place. But if you want to keep that Bradford pear, make sure that where the breakage occurred, that cut is cleaned up and not jagged.
Michelle, what's
up? Right now it's kind of ripped.
Yeah, that rip, it can open it up to disease.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here and tell you to get the chainsaw out and remove that Bradford pear. It is invasive. They're not great trees. Obviously, it broke in the storm. So right now, you can go to the Missouri Invasive Plant Council website. They're doing a program. It's called the Pear Buyback Program. If you send them, you sign up for the program online, send them a picture of your tree that you cut down, and then you can get a new Missouri native tree. I believe the pickup is in April, so I'm totally in agreement that we're cutting down all the Bradford pears, we're getting rid of them, and we're planting native trees. So that's just my opinion. But
all right, that's what I thought I was going to have to do.
All right, good luck to you.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, thank you,
Sarah. You're up next on the Garden Hotline with Michelle and Aaron.
Hello, my good friend Michelle. This is Sarah. I'm actually in Dallas, Texas.
Hi, Sarah.
I wanted to ask you about my crepe myrtle. So we have a new construction home. The crepe myrtle came with the house. It was great for the first couple of years. Then it seemed to get some sort of fungus on it. I may have very bad decision-y put some vinegar on it.
Why, Sarah? Why?
because a landscaper that came to look at my house told me to do that.
So I did.
So Sarah and I went to high school together. She's really one of my like besties for the restie. I think it's so funny that you're calling in, and thank you. Crepe myrtles actually tend to do better in your area in Texas than they do here in Missouri. I mean, they do really poorly here, especially with our winters. They get a lot of winter damage. So
yes.
So they're not doing great here in Missouri. For you, I would suspect that they are, doing a little bit better. But I would go ahead and try. Don't put vinegar down, Sarah. That's a really bad thing for plants. But I would cut it back to the ground and see if it flushes. And I'll call you later, though, Sarah, because we're at the end of our show and we've got to say goodbye. Love you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for calling, Michelle Reeser West, Pointer Landscaping, Aaron Goss from the Shaw Nature Reserve. Guys, this has been fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that is the Garden Hotline for today. I'm Scott Jagow. We'll talk to you soon.